There is a handout. It's really just there for you to scribble on. We'll follow roughly the structure of the handout, but not too closely. I'm here to speak at the Katoomba Men's Convention. Done two weekends, one weekend to go. And how did I end up being asked to come to Australia to speak on Song of Songs? Well, in September 2008, I was in South Africa and was asked to speak at a CESA church in Stellenbosch in the Western Cape. And I did what most people do if they're away from home and are asked to speak. I opened the sermons file in my computer, and I was actually sitting in the room with my wife. And I said, well, what'll I do? And I just preached a short series on kind of five Old Testament books over the summer. She said, why don't you do Song of Songs? So I brought the only sermon I have ever preached on Song of Songs. It lasted 23 minutes. It contained all that I knew about the book, which was basically stolen from Barry Webb, padded out with a few stories to make it last a bit longer. So I preached it, went on my way, didn't give it a second thought. 6 weeks later, after talking to someone who was there, the chairman of the Katoomba Men's Convention phoned me up and asked me to come to Australia and do these 3 weeks of the convention. That was a big enough shock in itself. Then he said, we'd like you to speak on Song of Songs. I said, but I don't know anything about Song of Songs. But he wouldn't be put off, and I kept suggesting alternatives, but no, for some reason, it had to be Song of Songs. So that's when my journey with this book began in earnest. Now, you know, I'd really love to tell you that, you know, I'd spent the last 6 months locked away on my, you know, mountain speaker's hideaway studying the book, but that would be a bit of a lie, because one wife, three children, two churches, some golf courses and some rugby grounds put paid to those intentions. But since I had to get into the book, it actually launched me on a journey which surprised me, because I think Song of Songs is basically the hardest book in the Old Testament to get our heads around. So what have I discovered? Well, the first thing I discovered is there are a lot of things we don't actually know about the Song of Songs. I don't know if you've ever looked at books on the Song of Songs, but if you pick up any two, you will find that they do not agree. In fact, they basically don't agree on anything about the book. You'll actually find the same with any two versions of the Bible. Even if you pick up the NIV and the ESV and look, you'll see they don't even agree with who is speaking at any particular point in the book. Sometimes they don't even agree on how many people are speaking. So that was great. That was a super start. So I went to find as many commentaries as I could get my hands on to get some help and to give me some clues as to how to come at this book. Things just kept getting better. I found out at this point that there are just about as many views of the Song of Songs as there are commentaries. And if you're into this kind of thing, you can while away many hours happily reading about the allegorical approach, the literal approach, the dramatic approach, the cultic approach, the political approach, the feminist approach, and my personal favorite, the psychological approach. One commentator said that the guy who'd adopted the psychological approach told us more about himself than he did about the Song of Songs. And I read through all this stuff and thought, you know, this really isn't helping. Because the problem with Song of Songs commentaries, or at least the 10 or 11 that I've looked at, is that they don't answer the question that I was asking, and I suspect most of us ask when every time we open the book. What is this book doing in the Bible? Okay. Now, just before I go any further, let me say a word about commentaries. There are lots of good commentaries on the text, you know, that will help you get your head around the different pictures and different images. I mean, some of those, Rick Hess has written a good one. I think it's in the Baker Exegetical Commentary series. Tremper Longman in the New International Commentary on the Old Testament's good. Ian Proven in the NIV Application Commentary is fine. The Old Tyndale Old Testament one by, I think it's Lloyd Carr, is good. There's a brand new one that's just out this month. It's an IVP commentary by Daniel Estes. Don't know what it's going to say, but they're all very useful in the text. But my problem, as I desperately read the introduction of all of these commentaries, is nobody tells us what it's doing in the Bible. I read more about Arabic love poetry than I ever wanted to know. I read more about the history of allegorical interpretations than I ever wanted to know. At one point, I even resorted to emailing Barry Webb in Sydney, saying, really liked your book. I need a bit more because I have to speak on this. And I saw that he was speaking at a conference in the UK later in May. I thought, brilliant. So I emailed him, got an email back, said, all I know about the Song of Songs is in my little book, Five Festal Garments. I haven't done any work for the conference in the UK, so I look forward to listening to your talks. Thanks, Barry. You know, now, I don't know about you, but when I have to wade through this kind of stuff, reading all this material, page after page, of people using very big words to say, we really don't know what this is about, I start to suspect that we must be missing something, and something pretty obvious at that. Because when we read the Bible, our starting point has to be that this is the Word of God. If it's the Word of God, which it is, and if God has given us the Spirit to understand the Word, which He has, then if we read it carefully and thoughtfully, then we really should be able to get the gist of what it's about. In other words, that if God speaks through the Bible, we can assume that He speaks clearly and in a way which we can understand if we read it properly. If you want a fancy word for that, the Reformers called it the perspicuity of Scripture. Now, that actually matters for us when we come to read this book. Because if we're reading the Song of Songs in a way that makes it seem obscure or irrelevant or incomprehensible or all over the place, then it is extremely likely that we're not reading it properly. We're missing something. And by extension, then, we are missing what God has to say to us through this part of the Bible, which is a big deal. So what are we to do? Well, I suggest we start by reading the text carefully. And when we do that, I think it turns out that what God has to say to us through this song is much more obvious than might appear. Of course, we aren't the first people to read this book. God's people have been trying to get to grips with this book for 2,500 years. And along the way, some people have said some very helpful things, and some people have said some very strange things about it, largely depending on the church's attitude to sex at the time the people are writing. Take Origen, for example. Origen was born in 185 AD in Alexandria, and over the next 1,000 years, what he said had a massive effect on how the church read the Bible as a whole, and Song of Songs in particular. He wrote a commentary on Song of Songs which stretched to 10 volumes. Now, that's a fairly significant achievement in and of itself, when you take into account that Origen wrote all 10 volumes without mentioning sex. I think it's a quite extraordinary achievement in the Song of Songs. Now, it turned out that Origen had a slightly messed up view of sex himself. He didn't like all that bodily stuff, thought it was decidedly unspiritual. And so, in an attempt to deal with his lustful thoughts, he castrated himself. And having done that, he went all the way and de-sexed the book of the Song of Songs. And so began a very long tradition of trying to avoid what is blatantly obvious on the pages of the book. So at the Westminster Assembly in the 17th century, they condemned anyone who viewed Song of Songs as a hot, carnal pamphlet formed by some loose Apollo or Cupid. John Wesley said that if it was about a couple, even a husband and wife, it would be absurd or monstrous. Strangely, one of the few voices saying, it's about sex, what's the big deal, was none other than a certain John Calvin, who isn't generally accused of being a good time Charlie. So, if many people down the centuries have insisted that this book isn't about love and sex, what did they think it was about? Well, simple, they thought it was all about Jesus. So, chapter 1, verse 2, if you look with me, says, let him kiss me with kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Isn't about kissing, it's actually about reading the Bible. How could you miss it? 1 verse 13, my beloved is to me a sachet of myrrh that lies between my breasts. That's talking about, well, wait for it, the sachet of myrrh is obviously Jesus, and the breasts are quite clearly the Old and New Testaments. We could go through the whole book, but as it's not the men's convention, I'll not. Now, it is easy to take kind of cheap shots at this, and there are plenty of strange things said. But the truth is that down the generations, what the church has signally failed to do is actually take the text of this book seriously. Because whatever else this book is talking about, it is talking about love and a sexual relationship, whatever that means. We'll look at that later. But whatever else we find in this book, we find the description of an increasingly intense relationship between a man and a woman. And there's nothing else in the book or elsewhere in either the Old Testament or the New Testament which gives us any reason to view it as anything other than that, a book primarily about a relationship between a man and a woman. But is it just the Bible's guide to better sex? Is that why God put it in here? If not, is it just some kind of divine joke to embarrass prudish Christians? What is it doing in here? Well, just look at the book and see. Here's how it starts. Solomon's Song of Songs. Okay? I'm not quite sure if you're looking at the NIV why they set it out quite the way they do. It looks like Solomon's Song of Songs is pushed up above the top of chapter 1. It's not. It's the first line of the book. Now, I don't want to insult your intelligence here, but there are a couple of important details to notice which sometimes seem to evade people who write commentaries on Song of Songs. Okay, first of all, this part of the Bible describes itself as the song. That's what the Song of Songs means. The ultimate love song. And I don't know if you get those cheesy ads on Australian TV for, you know, the ultimate love collection. You know, $9.99, you know, P.O. Box, whatever. But it's that kind of claim, the ultimate song about love, the final word about love. Now, I don't know about you, but that strikes me as a fairly huge claim to make. I don't know about you, but if you're married, would you go home to your husband or wife and say, I'm writing the definitive book on marriage? If you ever do, please let me know how your husband or wife responds. Now, that's why it's important to notice to whom this book is ascribed. It's Solomon. Now, I don't know how much you know about Solomon, but if you know anything about him, you probably know the two things that meant he was uniquely qualified to write the ultimate book on love, sex, and marriage. First of all, he was the wisest man who ever lived, which is, well, really, you'd need to be the wisest man who ever lived to step into this minefield. And the second thing, he was very experienced. 1 Kings 11 tells us he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. That is, women in his harem whom he hadn't got round to marrying. I do have some sympathy on that one, because if you'd had to go through 700 weddings and had a country to run, you know, you'd limited free time to work your way through the harem. Now, I don't know about you, but I've always had a slight problem with Solomon. How could you possibly be the wisest man on the planet and get married 700 times, let alone keep 300 concubines? How could you be so wise and yet fail so spectacularly to live up to the blueprint for the kings of Israel that God had given back in Deuteronomy 17? Now, just flick back to Deuteronomy 17 for a minute. Deuteronomy 17 from verse 14. When you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, let us set a king over us like all the nations around us, be sure to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses. In other words, a king who is completely unlike every king in the nations around us. Don't place a foreigner over you, one who is not your brother Israelite. The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them, for the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. What is he to do instead of that? Well, instead of spending time building up his harem or his fortune, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law, presumably Deuteronomy, taken from that of the priests who are Levites. It is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees, and not consider himself better than his brothers, and turn from the law to the right or the left. Then he and his descendants will reign a long time over his kingdom in Israel. So what's the king to do? He's to read his Bible, not think of himself as better than anyone else. That one seems to have slipped by Solomon, because Solomon builds up his massive collection of wives and concubines. Now, my problem is that surely if Solomon had God's wisdom, then sooner or later, perhaps as he tried to keep 700 mothers-in-law happy, or at Christmas, or, you know, it would dawn on him that it wasn't his brightest idea. Well, I wouldn't go to the stake for this, but I'm pretty sure that's exactly what happened. I think Solomon realized that he'd mucked it up, and that's when he wrote this book. Let me explain why. When I was at school in Ireland, they still had the marvelous habit of printing the answers at the back of the maths textbooks. And I confess that on more than one occasion, I availed of that provision before I should have. And I think it would save us a lot of confusion this evening if we went to the end of the book and looked at the answer. I think the key to this book is actually found in the last few verses. Chapter 8 from verse 11. Here's what it says. Solomon had a vineyard in Baal Hamon. He let out his vineyard to tenants. Each was to bring for its fruit 1,000 shekels of silver. This is the woman speaking. But my own vineyard is mine to give. 1,000 shekels are for you, O Solomon, and 200 are for those who tend its fruit. Now, I think these rather cryptic statements unlock the whole book. The woman is speaking, but what is she speaking about? She says, Solomon had a vineyard in Baal Hamon. Given the earlier references to vineyards in the book, which we'll see later on, this is almost certainly a reference not to wine growing, but to Solomon's harem. Baal Hamon may or may not be a real place, but the fact that it means Lord of the Multitude may well suggest that it's a figurative name, a place name given to wherever Solomon's harem was. So what about the tenants? Who are the tenants? Well, they're probably the staff of the harem. There were often eunuchs in the ancient world. Solomon may have gone down the same track, but we don't know. So let's go on. Let me read this. Each was to bring for its fruit 1,000 shekels of silver. Now, it's not immediately clear what these 1,000 shekels are about. But if we read on, I think it becomes clear, because the woman says this. My vineyard, that is my body, because she talks about her vineyard, her body as her vineyard in chapter 1, is mine to give. 1,000 shekels are for you, O Solomon, and 200 are for those who tend its fruit. Now, the 200 shekels probably refer to the exorbitant wages or the commission of those who were responsible for stocking Solomon's harem. So here's what would happen. Solomon would pick someone out, send the guys round to make the family an offer that they can't refuse, and sooner than you could say, wife number 701, come on down, it was sorted. Except it didn't work like that. There was, it seems, at least one feisty woman who was prepared to tell Solomon and his henchmen exactly what to do with their shekels. My vineyard is my own, and I'm not giving it to you. Keep it. Keep your money. You can pay your henchmen whatever you want, but don't try to buy me. Solomon, it seems, discovers that money, wisdom, and a team of blokes to go round and pay off the family can't buy you love. Now, if this is what those verses are saying, just think for a moment what that must have been like for Solomon. Solomon is the king. He is the wisest man in the world. He is rich. He is powerful. But who did this woman think she was? But I'd suggest that over time, Solomon began to reflect and to ask rather, who did he think he was? And right at the end of the book, in verses 13 to 14, as the lover and beloved walk off arm in arm into the sunset, Solomon is left to watch and think. He reflects on his life, not least on his love life, and realizes that somewhere along the line he's lost the plot. And he sits down to write this book. I spent 6 years working on the staff of a large church in Northern Ireland where I grew up. And at that time, the former minister, the previous minister of the congregation who built up the congregation was part of the church family. He was like kind of grandfather. And when I used to go to visit him, he always used to do two things. He always used to put a toffee in my pocket. It always made me feel like I was about six. You know, as he said, oh, just wait there. And he would go and come back with a paper bag. And he never get put it in my hand. He always put it into my pocket. And then he would say, he said, Gary, he said, promise me one thing. He said, you know, the only thing I regret in my lifetime in ministry is that I neglected my family. I was a stranger to them as they grew up. Promise me you won't do that. Now, picture Solomon looking back on his life and his conquests and realizing that in all that, he has actually missed out on real love and even on delighting in God himself. And now he says to us through this book, make sure you don't do what I did. Promise me. And he sits down to write this book. And so he writes about a young couple who are passionately and exclusively and selflessly in love. They're permanently and utterly committed to each other, as we shall see. And who are these two lovers? It's not immediately apparent. We'll trace this through in a minute. At points it seems like it might be Solomon himself, but as the book goes on, that becomes less and less likely. Because at the end of the book, he is clearly an outsider. And as this couple disappear into the sunset, he is left alone. See, this really is the ultimate love song. And I would argue that when you read the book in this light, it's a book, a song, which exposes the emptiness of sex without love, celebrates the delight of love in the context of marriage, and finally takes us back to God himself. Okay? Now, that's basically where I'm coming from. You may need me to justify that a little bit, and I'll do it. I'll do it in a minute. What we need to do now is to go back and work through the book to see if there is evidence to back up this understanding of the book. Because as I said, I wouldn't necessarily go to the stake for this, but having read as many commentaries as I can find in the Song of Songs, I've at last found something which, to me at least, makes sense of what this book is doing in the Bible and unfolds a very clear message. But just let me say one thing before we do that. I think we have to be aware, as soon as we start reading this book, and if we begin teaching it in any context, probably unlike any other book in the Bible, it opens up a whole raft of very difficult and often painful pastoral issues. Because as soon as we start talking about love and sex and relationships, as soon as we start looking at the kind of ideal relationship we find in the Song of Songs, people will start feeling very edgy. People who are aching for a relationship will feel edgy. People who are already in a relationship, but it may not be the ideal relationship, and let's face it, who has the ideal relationship, they will start feeling edgy. People who have messed up sexually will feel edgy. People who are grappling with issues of their own sexuality will feel edgy. Some people will start feeling resentful, inadequate. So the way in which we handle this book in the context of the church, whether it's a youth group or the whole congregation or a Bible study group, has to be very carefully thought through, because we will open all sorts of raw wounds and bring issues to the surface. So we do need to be careful. But let me just pause it. Anybody got any kind of pressing questions just now? Good. Let's jump back into the text, okay? Chapter 1, verse 2. The book starts, as we've seen already, fairly intensely. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. An unidentified woman starts talking. She comes straight to the point. It's quite striking in this book. That the woman speaks first. But before you get too worked up about that, I don't think this is part of an early feminist agenda. Nor do I think, incidentally, Song of Songs has got anything to contribute to the discussion on roles of husbands and wives. Go to Ephesians 5 if you want to know about that. In this book, the woman speaks first and speaks more because she is a woman. She's not trying to undermine the principle of submission or anything like that. I think she's a bit feisty. You see that all the way through. This woman, as I think Solomon himself finds out later to his cost, has a mind of her own. Straight up, he is introducing us to this woman who will not simply jump when Solomon or anyone else clicks her fingers. Now, I think all of us know women like this. Many of us are married to them. Women who are brighter than we are, smarter than we are, better at arguing than we are, and who aren't just content to have our babies and worship at our feet. So I think this book kind of smacks of realism right from the start. But let's keep going. This woman wants to kiss her man, not least because he smells good. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. There you go. But it's not just his aroma, it's his character. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder maidens love you. Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chambers. So who is this woman? We don't know yet. Who is it she wants to kiss her? We don't know yet, other than the fact that she calls him the king. If you're a married man, you might try suggesting to your wife that she calls you this at least once a day. See if you get away with it. It's worth a try anyway. But we don't know yet who this is, okay? And then we come to this, verses 5 and 6. Dark am I, yet lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I am dark, because I am darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyards. My own vineyard I have neglected. Okay, now, I don't think this means that she was bottling her own vintage. Okay, this woman is sunburned because she's forced to work in the fields. This woman's also part of a dysfunctional family, which makes it clear that even though there's loads of idealism in the Song of Songs, this stuff takes place in the real world, the messy world. And the last thing is that this woman was insecure about her appearance. Now, please don't ask me why, but this seems to be true of almost all women everywhere. My wife Fiona runs a women's Bible study in our house on Tuesday mornings. Try to get offside. A couple of weeks ago, I was just in trying to get a fresh cup of coffee before they got going. And I listened to the most incredible conversation. Where these women were standing, comparing their insecurities, I'll spare you the details, about their figures and their weight and the way in which they looked. At one point I said, sorry, I'm still here. But it didn't put them off, you know, because they just had this shared assumption that they were all slightly insecure about their appearance. That's exactly what we see at the start of this book. Which is why the man opens up in the way in which he does. You can see that verse 9. This is one of the challenges of preaching this book. I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with strings of jewels. We will make you earrings of gold studded with silver. Verse 15. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes are doves. Now, just for a minute, ignore the fact that he says she looks like a big horse. We'll come back to that in a second. But I think one of the things Solomon's trying to get across is that the man works really hard to make his beloved feel beautiful. I don't know if you've ever watched or listened to any of Mark Driscoll's talks on Song of Songs. He says a lot of very helpful things. A lot of things which just made me think, how did you ever say that in public? I'm not sure he helps us understand Song of Songs all that well, but one of the things he does say is that for the man in Song of Songs, his beloved is his standard of beauty, which is a very helpful thing. You know, so what my standard of beauty just now is 39-year-old Scottish women who are 5'3", slightly freckled, who think their ankles are fat. My standard of beauty is about to change to 40-year-old, 5'3", Scottish women who've got freckles and think their ankles are fat. And she said, Driscoll helpfully points out that the way in which the man speaks shows that his wife is his standard of beauty. Okay? Now, you just listen to some of the things he says. Chapter 4, flick over there. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are doves. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep just shorn, coming up from the washing. Each has its twin. Not one of them is alone. I do need to point out that when you're reading Song of Songs, you need to remember that many markers of beauty are specific to particular cultures. So presumably to say in Israel, when Solomon is around, you have all your teeth, was likely to elicit a warm and grateful response. Try that one in Ireland, you'll probably get a smack in the nose. And speaking of noses, I do find it hard to see how saying your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon was ever a smart move. One of my friends suggested it might have been a fairly small tower, but, you know, it's still a tower, you know. But even when the particular images sound a bit strange, and this is where the commentaries are excellent at helping us to work through those details of the text, you do need to be pretty slow to miss the point. You know, verse 3, your lips are like a scarlet ribbon, your mouth is lovely, your temples behind your veil are like the halves of a pomegranate. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with elegance. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your two breasts are like two fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle. Not even going to try to explain that, other than to say that obviously the beloved liked the comparison. Verse 7, all beautiful you are, my darling, there is no flaw in you. Verse 9, you've stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You've stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your perfume than any spice. Your lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like that of Lebanon. You've got to be careful for that last one, with that last one, particularly if you come from Ireland. You smell like Dublin, for example, may be misinterpreted as saying you smell like the Guinness Brewery. But you have to choose your comparisons well. But when you allow, you read through this text and allow it just to wash over you, it is clearly very moving and very powerful. And in teaching this book, I think actually, for parts of it, the most effective thing is just to have it read by a man and a woman. My two favorite images actually come in chapter 7. Chapter 7, verse 1, which paraphrased basically says, your graceful legs are like the legs of a good chair. And 7 verse 2, your navel is a rounded goblet that never lack blended wine. It's not far from saying your navel is a great place to hold a beer, but not, you know, no. But I think what is clear is that this is immensely imaginative. I know it's strange to say this of a man, but this man thinks. He puts all of his effort into speaking in a loving way to his wife. And that's one of the things that actually is a huge challenge coming out of the Song of Songs. Dale Ralph Davis tells a story about how he was clearing out a room at the back of his garage, and he was getting really annoyed. It was hot and it was dusty and he wasn't getting anywhere. And I don't know if you've ever been clearing out a room and you've got to this stage, there's so much rubbish in there, you can't even find anywhere to stand. You can't move it anywhere. So he's getting more and more ratty. And eventually the door opened, and he said, what do you want? He said, I thought it was my wife. When it turned out to be the nice Baptist lady next door, I was terribly embarrassed. And he says one of the things that it showed him was both the rotten state of his own heart and a problem he had with his attitude to his wife. And I think that's one of the challenges in the actual rhetoric, in the discussion of the Song of Songs. There is this deep, deep tenderness between these two people. And I think at the kind of macro level, that's one of the challenges that we have to face, to draw out as we teach this book. So to ask, you know, very practical questions, have husbands and wives been getting irritated with each other? Have they been treating each other functionally? Have they been speaking to each other as if they treasure each other, as if they cherish each other? One of the questions I ask the men at the men's convention is, if your wife were here, what would she give you out of 10 for the way in which you've been speaking to her over the last week? Safe to ask that question when your wife's 12,000 miles away. You can't ask her until you get home. But these are the kind of basic challenges that flow out simply from the language of the book. Okay? Anybody any questions so far? Yeah. Yeah, I'll come back to that in a second. Yeah. That's in, if you're gonna hold off. I think let me say this. The book nowhere gives us any commentary or even necessarily any clue about, you know, the marital state of these two, but it is clear and it's assumed all the way through that their relationship is exclusive, that it's committed, that it's lifelong. And Solomon doesn't answer the question, when do they get married? We're not even told, you know, if, you know, the timing of the various bits of the book. But in the ancient Near Eastern context, it would be unthinkable to have this kind of heady relationship that wasn't within that kind of broader context of betrothal, you know, lifelong commitment, marriage. So it's slightly anachronistic, perhaps, you know, to say. But I think the primary application of the book is to couples who are radically, permanently committed to each other, which in our culture is essentially those who are on the kind of engaged, married spectrum. Okay. How are we going? Should we take a break there? Is that happy to take a break, Lee? How long have we got?
5 minutes.
Okay, you've got 5 minutes to stretch your legs, and then we'll get back into the text.